Coming up, the difficulties and rewards of interracial congregations. And Christians trying to reclaim St. Nicholas from secular Christmas celebrations.
If we don't recover this tradition, I believe we are going to eventually lose Christmas.
Plus Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Millions of Christians and Jews around the world are preparing for the holy and festive holidays of Christmas and Hanukkah. We'll have more on both traditions later in the program. President-elect Barack Obama has chosen two prominent ministers to pray during his inauguration. Civil rights leader and Methodist minister Joseph Lowery will deliver the benediction. Protestant evangelical megachurch pastor Rick Warren will deliver the opening prayer. The choice of Warren has ignited considerable debate. Gay rights advocates are angry because Warren has publicly opposed gay marriage. At the same time, some conservative religious activists criticized Warren for accepting the invitation because Obama supports abortion rights. In what analysts are calling one of the worst episodes in American philanthropic history, scores of Jewish charities are thought to have lost hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeshiva University and the American Jewish Congress, among many others, had invested with Bernard Madoff, a financier who had close ties to Jewish groups. Last week, Madoff revealed that he had defrauded his investors, including philanthropists and their charities. At least two charities have already shut down. A UN International Criminal Tribunal has sentenced the main organizer of the 1994 Rwandan genocide to life imprisonment. The court ruled that Colonel Theoneste Bagosora was responsible for ordering the military to kill political opponents and ethnic rivals. More than 800,000 people died in the slaughter. In Zimbabwe and southern Africa, in a country that has been suffering from political and economic chaos, a cholera outbreak has become a humanitarian crisis. More than 1,000 people have died and tens of thousands are infected. Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders, and other aid groups are appealing for relief. Meanwhile, neighboring countries have offered help. They fear cholera will spread to their own populations. The election of Barack Obama caused many Americans to be proud of the country's movement toward racial integration and also to re-examine the difficulties involved in that, not least in churches, where 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is still the most segregated hour of the week. Lucky Severson has our special report.
Lift your voice. It's a year of jubilee.
If something seems odd or unusual about these worshipers, maybe it's the diversity, all the different colors and nationalities of their faces. This is the Wilchrist Baptist Church in Houston, and Pastor Rodney Wu couldn't be more proud of the cultural and racial mix of his congregation.
I think my main passion is to get people ready for heaven. I think a lot of our people are going to go into culture shock when they get to heaven, and they get to sit next to somebody that they didn't maybe sit with while they were here on earth. So we're trying to get them acclimated a little bit.
Assuming Pastor Wu is right, there are a lot of congregations that need to get acclimated. A recent study found that only 7% of churches in the U.S. are integrated. This comes as no surprise to Ohio State sociology professor Corey Edwards, author of the book The Elusive Dream.
We're segregated in housing. Even the job market is segregated. We end up going to churches with people who look like us.
So sometimes, you know, you'll hear the statement of African Americans saying, I have to work with whites, I may have to shop with them, but on Sunday I don't want to have to worship with them. I want to be able to just be myself and let my hair down.
Rice University sociology professor Michael Emerson, who authored the study on the makeup of churches in the U.S., says racial separation inside most churches is even more pronounced than it is outside for a number of reasons.
What we found in the study is that the churches are 10 times less diverse than the neighborhoods they sit in.
Emerson also found that churches in the South were the least integrated, partly because African Americans are concerned about whites taking over their congregation.
That's a big fear, right? And when I talk with black pastors, the same thing. If we try to have this move towards interracial congregations, whites will just dominate then. There's so many more of them, and they're used to being in the position of power, so they'll just take over and we'll lose the one thing we do have.
And so what happens in these congregations where you have whites and blacks, even though they may be well-intended, people coming together, wanting to do the Christian thing, wanting to serve God together, you're going to find that these kinds of issues that occur outside of the church come into the church.
The top of the morning to everybody.
Pastor Rufus Smith of the City of Refuge Church in Houston is one of very few African Americans who leads an interracial church. Smith says when he took over the Evangelical Presbyterian congregation, it was mostly white, bored, and dwindling. He said he would only agree to be pastor if members promised to integrate.
To their credit, many of those core people decided, you know, come hell or high water, we're going to try this thing and give it our best shot, though it was an experiment. And here now, 12 years later, we think it's a grand experience.
Today, the church is about 45% white, 45% black, and the rest Hispanic and Asian. But Pastor Smith says the grand experience hasn't always been pleasant.
You're certainly up against the natural stereotypes. You're up against ignorance. You're up against some hard-heartedness and, some outright evil with respect to some people.
Pastor Rodney Wu, half Chinese, grew up in a black neighborhood, went to an all-white church, and married his Hispanic childhood sweetheart.
The poor rich, let me tell you who they are. They are the people who have a lot of money and nothing else.
When he came here, the church had only two black members out of 180. Today, Willchrist Baptist has 500 members divided almost equally among whites, blacks, and Hispanics, with the remainder made up of Asians. Wu says he didn't realize how difficult it was going to be integrating his church.
When we started, a lot of people were going, this is making me feel uncomfortable. Whether the kids were in the nursery together or their kids were in the youth group, a lot of parents were fearful that their kids might start dating somebody that was a different race.
In the beginning stages, there's often a lot of pain, a lot of confusion, a lot of people leave. Maybe there's even anger. But if they can make it through that, it becomes something that people just, a lot of times will say, I couldn't live without it.
Ask me how I feel. If I was any better, I would have to be twins. And that's the truth if I ever told it.
Pastor Rufus Smith has succeeded in not only integrating his church racially, his congregation comes from all walks of life. When it grew, he deliberately located the church between affluent and low-income neighborhoods. Carol Vance, a former district attorney, was one of the founding members.
We picked Rufus because he's a great pastor, not because he's black. But I think it's wonderful that he is, because we're sitting right here on the edge, and I sort of like to think of our church as the bridge over troubled waters.
To me, one of the true tests of the power of the gospel is to unify people across socioeconomic, racial lines, which is what the heart of Christianity is and was.
Karen Giesen has a doctorate degree in theology. She says she grew up in a white church where people bowed their head, folded their hands, and worshiped quietly. Very different from what she experiences at City of Refuge.
The worship style is an issue. None of us are right in probably our heart language style. I mean, we're all making a sacrifice to be there. It's a mix. A lot of people go looking for churches saying, I'm looking for the one that ministers to me. And to go here, we've obviously all made a choice that we want to serve there.
Rebecca Miller wants to be a pastor. She says she searched to find a church that felt like a community.
People worship the way the Spirit leads them to worship. I really don't think that there is anybody saying you can't shout, you can't scream, you can't say hallelujah, and you can't clap your hands. It's not the typical Presbyterian, you can't raise your head church.
Where we really changed, and we saw the growth grow exponentially, was when the church became less than 50% white, and so there was no majority group. And that just changed the entire mindset.
Church guitarist Jim Cruz married a Hispanic and adopted a Hispanic child. He says he's learning a few things about his own prejudice.
It's what we're learning is that you may not come to it thinking you're prejudiced. You may be seriously trying not to be prejudiced. But then you find out the things you're doing come across as prejudiced. So I think a lot of our effort has been to learn to relax, to let people be people.
It would be difficult to find a more graphic example of religion bridging a racial divide than Dwight Pryor and Rick Taylor. Taylor describes himself as a reformed redneck.
From where I come from, be honest, I was taught to hate people like Dwight and to not have anything to do with them, and that they were less than I was. And I believed that most of my life. I truly did. But the Lord has a way of showing you your prejudices in your life.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in North Mississippi. As a little kid on those school buses, watching those people shout racist names at me, and some of them were deacons and pastors in our community, it left a cold chill in my heart, a hatred.
Dwight is a control systems designer, and Rick is a retired general contractor. The bond that has grown between them is plain to see.
Racism colors the truth. It makes people not look at other people as if they were human. It goes that deep. Mm-hmm. It truly does.
It sure does.
And Christ teaches us that we're all the same.
Are churches that integrate richer because they did it?
Yeah, I never meet a church that wishes they didn't do it. I never meet a leader that wishes they didn't do it. They will all say to the person, it's hard, it's difficult. It comes with complexities and confusion.
And they will say, if they're like Dwight and Rick, that church integration may not always come easy, but it comes with rich rewards and improbable friendships. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Houston.
In other news, the Bush administration issued a new regulation allowing healthcare workers to refuse to offer services that conflict with their moral or religious beliefs. The rule extends protections to every worker in the healthcare system and also covers services that reach beyond abortion, such as dissemination of contraceptives. Many religious groups praise the rule, but many healthcare groups, including the American Medical Association, said it would create obstacles to necessary care. The Obama administration or congressional action could repeal or overrule the regulation. One of the pillars of the religious right has died. Paul Weyrich was 66 years old and had been in poor health for years. Weyrich was a conservative activist who long argued that religious believers should be politically vocal. He helped create both the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition. Pope Benedict XVI said this week that the worldwide economic crisis can bring not only suffering, but also rediscovery of the true values of Christmas. In his words, when the consumerist and materialistic scales have been shed. Getting the right balance at Christmas time between the sacred and the secular is a concern of many Christians, among them those urging more attention to the 4th century bishop St. Nicholas, the inspiration for Santa Claus. Kim Lawton reports.
Jolly old St. Nicholas, lead your ear this way.
It's the season of Santa Claus, and it seems he's everywhere. Children anxiously await the arrival of Santa, who is, of course, bearing gifts. But some Christians are worried that most of those children, and their parents as well, don't know who jolly old St. Nicholas really was.
St. Nicholas was a real person, not a fairy, not someone who's flying through the sky and with reindeer, but an actual person who lived and worked and died and had a full life. He had a Christian life because he was actually a bishop, a pastor.
As director of communications for the Worldwide Anglican Communion, Canon Jim Rosenthal was always on the lookout for images of bishops. He says he was captivated by a 4th century bishop named Nicholas. Now Rosenthal helps lead an international movement urging churches to reclaim St. Nicholas.
I believe that St. Nicholas and his tradition is something that needs to be recovered, and now.
Rosenthal is founder of the UK-USA St. Nicholas Society.
The children are getting these that say, I met the real and true Santa Claus and Father Christmas.
Every year he dresses up like St. Nicholas, complete with the bishop's staff, called a crozier, and his distinctive hat, called a mitre.
I have to decide if I should wear one of those mitres or this mitre. This is the most pretty one.
He visits churches to help spread the St. Nicholas message.
If we don't recover this tradition, I believe we are going to eventually lose Christmas, any semblance of a religious Christmas.
Nicholas was born in Asia Minor when the new Christian faith was beginning to spread across the Roman Empire.
He came from a very wealthy family. His parents died at an early age. His uncle was a priest. That was the undivided church in those days. There was no Roman Catholic Church or other kinds of churches, one church. And he became a priest like his uncle.
Nicholas rose to leadership in the early church and was named Bishop of Myra, a city on the southern coast of what is now Turkey. During a time of persecution by Roman Emperor Diocletian, Nicholas was imprisoned for his outspoken faith. He was eventually released and continued his ministry until his death on December 6th in the year 343.
And he was known for his generosity and his goodwill because he was very rich. He literally, by the end of his life, gave away all of his fortune. Many stories talk about the fact that he was so generous that he became known as the gift giver.
More and more churches in the U.S. and the U.K. are finding ways to keep the St. Nicholas stories alive. For example, the Episcopal Cathedral of Chicago hosted a special St. Nicholas exhibit.
The stories of St. Nicholas are wonderful stories of a bishop who cared about his people, who cared very much about the poor.
There are numerous tales of Nicholas doing good deeds, performing miracles, calming the seas, stopping famine, and rescuing children. Separating truth from myth can be difficult.
My guess is that some of the fanciful stories that have moved into the realm of legend and miracle had their roots in very concrete acts of very real kindness and generosity.
One of the most famous stories involves a poor family who couldn't afford marriage dowries for their 3 daughters.
The parents were going to have to sell them off into slavery or into prostitution or whatever, and St. Nicholas came by the house at night and dropped off 3 bags of gold coins.
Some legends say he secretly tossed the bags of gold through an open window, and one landed in stockings or shoes that were drying by the fire, thus launching the tradition of the Christmas stocking. Pawnbrokers have especially embraced the story.
If you go to a pawnbroker shop, you'll see 3 gold balls. Those represent the 3 bags of gold, which we now turn into chocolate coins, that St. Nicholas threw through the window to save 3 girls from slavery or prostitution.
Nicholas has been adopted by many groups beyond pawnbrokers.
So many people love him, and so many people wanted him as theirs, that he's the patron saint of almost everything. Unwed women, children, which of course is the most prominent, pawnbrokers, sailors and merchants and cookie makers, apothecaries, I mean, you just name it, and he has something to do with it.
Many European countries have a long tradition of celebrating the feast day of St. Nicholas on December 6th. Then St. Nicholas evolved into Santa Claus and got all tied up with Christmas.
If you look at the words, the name Santa Claus, you will see it's Santa means saint, and Claus is simply an abbreviation from Nicholas. But the reality is he became a secular image.
Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
American writers and advertisers helped disseminate a new myth that made no mention of the jolly old saint's religious connections.
We always talk about roots and being politically correct. Let's be politically correct about Santa Claus and give him his proper title.
Church leaders emphasize that St. Nicholas's generosity was motivated by his Christian faith. The saint was following Jesus' commands to love others, help those who are suffering, give sacrificially, and to do one's good deeds in secret. They say Nicholas is a reminder that Christmas is really about the coming of Jesus.
The problem with Santa Claus as it stands now is it's a substitute for Christmas. Santa Claus instead of the creche, instead of the manger, instead of the nativity scene. This man we would find kneeling at the nativity scene, saying, "This is what I'm here to celebrate as well."
Nicholas may have been called the gift giver, but Christians teach that on Christmas, God gave the world the ultimate gift, Jesus.
Symbolically, as a Christian leader, St. Nicholas is pointing, like other Advent stories, pointing towards this event called Christmas, which as Christians we believe is the most wonderful night of the year.
And that, they say, is the true meaning of St. Nicholas. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
And now, belief and practice, the 8-day Jewish celebration of Hanukkah. In the 2nd century B.C., after the Hebrew temple in Jerusalem had been desecrated by foreign conquerors, a miracle is believed to have occurred. When the Jews went in to reclaim and rededicate their temple, the lamp oil that usually lasted just one day burned instead for 8. That inspired the Festival of Lights. We visited the Ninio family in Rockville, Maryland, as they gathered with friends to celebrate. We also talked with Jewish scholar and author Erica Brown of the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington, who explained the lighting of the menorah.
In Israel today, you'll find that most menorahs, or as they're called, chanukiyot, are lit outside because that's the way the commandment should be fulfilled. But because of persecution throughout Jewish history, people lit indoors and they placed their menorahs on tables inside their homes. On Hanukkah, every night we add an additional candle. We begin with one, and the last night we light 8 candles. We light them with the aid of a shamash, which is the center candle or the central candle, and you'll see it often has a special place on a menorah. Make 2 blessings on the lighting of the candles. We actually have another blessing that we say on the first night, which is a generalized blessing. Thank you, God, for bringing us to this day. And then we add 2 special blessings just about the miracles of these days. And it's a good time to think about the miracles in our own lives. But we also don't use the Hanukkah lights for anything else. So, for example, we wouldn't use them to read by or to do any kind of mundane activities by. They're a sacred sort of light while they're burning. Because it's a holiday where we celebrate a small jug of oil that lasted miraculously for 8 days, we celebrate all kinds of food cooked with oil. Latkes, which are fried potato pancakes, are very popular this season. People eat them with applesauce and sour cream. The other thing that's quite popular is our sufganiyot, or donuts. I think the holiday season is a time of a lot of generosity and a lot of compassion and goodwill. I do a lot of community teaching in high-tech firms and law firms and other firms. In today's class, we looked at sources on light and talked about the magical properties of light as a way to start talking about responsibility. How do we have a responsibility when we can see the vulnerable, when we can see the oppressed, can't walk away from them? Hanukkah is a time where we take responsibility for the world, not only for ourselves, but for spreading kindness through the world. Certainly at this season of the year, I think many Jews, even highly assimilated Jews, feel a lack of belonging in the mainstream culture. And Hanukkah's always been a good time for them to come together in a social setting to feel a sense of belonging with each other.
On our calendar, a busy week. Hanukkah begins at sundown on Sunday. President Bush has already observed the holiday in a White House ceremony, joining Jewish leaders in the lighting of a menorah. And on Thursday, Christians celebrate Christmas, the birthday of Jesus. Christmas trees have already gone up in many parts of the world, including Manger Square in Bethlehem, the traditional birthplace of Jesus. Other popular decorations for the holiday are nativity scenes, especially in Italy, where in addition to Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, there are often figures resembling pop culture and political personalities. This year, in a manger tableau in Naples, the Obamas. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah. There's much more on our website, including more of our interview with Michael Emerson about multiracial congregations and more about religion and politics on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, the Integrity Gospel Group.